Laura Van Holstein, thank you so much for coming on to Evolution Soup from your home in Cambridge, United Kingdom. You are a PhD candidate studying evolutionary biology and anthropology at the University of Cambridge, and just last month, March 2020, you published your revolutionary research into the role of subspecies in evolution. How have you been doing, Laura, since the news of your discovery hit the headlines? You must be getting a lot of attention and messages about your work and how, as the press have put it, you've proved one of Darwin's evolutionary theories.
Yeah, that's right, Mark. Well, first of all, thank you for having me on. So that's right. So we published the research last month, and that kind of coincided with, you know, the social isolation and the lockdown happening in the UK. And weirdly, for me, like you kind of anticipated, I feel like my social life, especially with people I don't know, has kind of exploded. So rather than being very isolated, I've been talking to people a lot.
Yeah.
And yeah, I did. I have received some strange messages. So people, it kind of falls into a few categories. So we have the people that are very angry that I'm doing, you know, evolutionary biology, and it's nothing against me personally. It's just the fact that I study evolution because evolution doesn't happen, or it's wrong. So it's messages like that, you know, where they try and educate, or they want to educate me on evolutionary biology. And then some people are very angry that I've said that humans, so we don't have subspecies. And I think we'll get into that a little bit later on in the show, because it's a good question. People are very keen on the idea of us having subspecies. And then there are some really weird people that have insinuated all kinds of things about why I am where I am. I basically don't do the work, is what they insinuate, and that's bizarre. I mean, they actually,
that's very strange.
It feels weird. But yeah, so but also lots of interest in the methods, in the implications, that kind of thing. So also nice interest. So it's not been all bad. And then you say correctly that the press have said that I've proven one of Darwin's theories, and I have to kind of be the killjoy and the party pooper in this and say that if you're doing science in a way that I guess is accepted, is you can't really prove anything per se. It's more you give enough evidence to suggest that something is correct or the case. So that's essentially what we did in that publication, is to give evidence for something that Darwin predicted.
Okay, we're going to be talking about a lot of fascinating things in this interview, but before we begin, can you just tell us a little bit about your background?
I was born in Holland, but I've kind of lived all over the place. And I did my undergrad degree at Cambridge, and the degree itself was very broad. It was called Human, Social, and Political Sciences. And I basically, in my personal statement, because in the UK you have to write your personal statement, I basically said that I just couldn't choose what I found interesting, so I just wanted to, go into the broadest course possible, basically. So that was Human, Social, and Political Sciences, and then I specialised pretty much after my first year already. I decided that biological anthropology was a thing that actually really grabbed my attention, because it was still very broad, but it was kind of looking at humanity from a biological perspective. There's lots of different perspectives you can take, but that was the thing that sort of resonated with me most. So I ended up specializing in biological anthropology, or bioanthropology, I'll probably end up calling it during this interview. Right. And then after my undergrad degree, I basically did field work in Kenya for a while as part of the In Africa project. Yeah, that was because I was really used to, the kind of sitting behind your desk reading thousands of papers and kind of drowning in words, and then suddenly you're taken out of that, the sort of ivory tower, and then you're taken into the northern Kenyan desert to actually look for these things, and that was really cool. And then
in the footsteps of the Leakeys and everything.
Yeah, and actually I did meet the Leakeys, and we work at their institute, TBI, the Turkana Basin Institute. A lot of the stuff that is found as part of the In Africa project is kept in TBI. That was a crazy world and a brilliant experience. And then I worked in a medical consultancy for a while, did an internship. So that was kind of a completely different side of science and applying it to the medical side of things and more especially the kind of medical policy and that kind of thing. And then I started my PhD, which I'm honestly in the process of completing, but it's a long process, put it that way. but yeah, I'm in my third year now.
Right. I think the best place to start is to ask what exactly is meant by a subspecies?
Yeah, that's a very good question. So when I talk about my research, people are always, they're like, oh, that's interesting. And then they think about it more. And people that know about issues with species definitions are like, well, if we can't even say what a species is, how on earth are you going to tell me what a subspecies is? And the thing is, subspecies are actually better defined than species, I would say. So we have, I think it's like 30 definitions of species and only one functional definition of subspecies. So subspecies essentially means that you've got a population that represents a break from everything else you see in the species. And it has to represent a break in three ways. So the first is it has to have its own range, its distinct, usually a breeding range. And then it has to represent a break in phenotype. And that sounds like a really vague thing, but there's actually published rules about how much difference you should expect to see. So basically, that rule is called the 75% rule. And what you want is 75% of the members of your proposed subspecies cannot overlap phenotypically with 99% of the rest of the species. So of course you still have a tiny bit.
For anyone who doesn't know, a phenotype is
basically what you look like, your external characteristics. So basically what that means is it has to actually represent a distinct unit within the species. And then genetically it's a little bit more complicated, but you don't want the subspecies to be completely reproductively isolated from the rest of the species, because by then, and what I mean by that is, they never interbreed, because by then what you've basically got is a separate species.
It's a new species, yeah.
That's right, yeah, a new species. So to give some examples, I actually have a book next to me. This is probably my favorite book, actually, apart from Lord of the Rings, but where I have some examples. Oh yeah, so this is by Jonathan Kingdon, and it's his field guide to African mammals. So there's some really nice examples if people are interested, because what he does is a lot of the time he draws very clearly what the differences are between varieties or subspecies. So I thought I'd give some examples. So first, of course, you've got the chimpanzees, and you can contrast them with the bonobos. So they're both members of the same genus, Pan. But chimpanzees have four subspecies, and bonobos have no subspecies. Kingdon sort of describes what the differences are between the subspecies, but what you'll see on the screen is that they have their own separate ranges, and then Kingdon goes into some detail describing the differences. So you've got things like the Verus subspecies has a dark face, but then a light muzzle, and they're bearded. And then you've got Pan troglodytes, which is very pale, has a freckled face, and darkens with age. These kinds of differences. So they're phenotypically distinct from each other, and they have their own range. And then we get to my favorite group of monkeys, just because they really lend themselves to painting. They're very photogenic. So it's the Cercopithecus monkeys. and Kingdon has a nice illustration of the lesser spot-nosed monkey, which has two subspecies, and again they have their own ranges, and the main differences, and you can see that very clearly, are in the face. So I find this very difficult to pronounce, but the Butycophori subspecies basically has brown spots on its face, and the other subspecies just doesn't have that. And you can also see in the pictures that the shape of the coloration is different as well. I guess we'll move on to what else did I want to show? Oh yeah, they're very cute. Ogilby's Duiker. I say that with a Dutch accent, but I think it's Duiker also in English. But yeah, basically you've
I've spoken to a lot of scientists and they don't know how to pronounce a lot of these binomial names at all.
because I have no idea. So sorry to the doubters, but so there's three subspecies in this species, and they look very distinct. So they have very different coloration, different, especially on the face. And again, they have their own distinct ranges. Kingdon makes the point that they could be considered species, so we need to look at the genetics of these. And that, I think, illustrates the point really well that I make in the paper, that subspecies can become species over time. And that's what we sort of give evidence for. And that's kind of what, you know, this Dauker example illustrates, that you get this regional diversification, and then if that persists for long enough, they could, over time, become species. And of course, we've got the tigers as well, which are very topical at the moment, tiger subspecies. But in existence today, we've got six tiger subspecies. It used to be nine, but three have gone extinct. So you've got the people with the mullets saying saying that we can just, you know, because they're really, really endangered, we can we can breed them all together, and that'll increase genetic diversity. We could just release them into the wild, and that'll save the species. And actually, that just makes no sense when you look at the genetic data, but also when you look at their phenotypes. And, you know, you get everything from the I think it's called the Amur subspecies, which, you know, lives in the north. And it's huge. I think it's on average, there's something, the males are something like 170 kilos. They have very thick coats. They're much lighter on average because, you know, they're in more snowy environments. And then contrast that with the Sumatran tiger, and the tiny, 100 kilos on average, the males. That's a big difference. So that's like, you know, an adult human male, I guess. That's their kind of weight. And they have very their stripes are very close together, and their coats are very thin, so they're adapted to their own environment. And, you know, there have been studies distinctively showing that these are six independent units of conservation concern. And so what you're doing when you're breeding all of these subspecies together and just creating generic tigers is you're getting rid of all of that local adaptation that subspecies represent. And if you then release that into the wild, you're probably going to cause a situation in which those locally adapted subspecies are out-competed because you've just suddenly put loads of generic ones in. We don't even really know much about some of these subspecies, and they themselves will go extinct and be out-competed by. So it's don't believe the people with the mullets.
what you're saying is that when a group becomes a subspecies, it's already got, as it were, the mechanism to speciate into something new. But if you mess around with it, like you're describing, it sort of like stymies that.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. So basically what you're seeing is with subspecies is adaptation to local environments. And that kind of is a very typical, you know, if there's barriers, if barriers form between those subspecies, or if they just remain isolated for long enough, you've got the archetypical case of allopatric speciation, which is where you've got a barrier between what used to be populations of the same species, and they, you know, adapt to their own environment and become future species. So you're right.
And I think you mentioned giraffes as well, the spots on them.
Yeah, that's right. So giraffe spots. So you've got four species of giraffes, I think, and then two of those four species have subspecies. The other two don't have any subspecies. One of them has three subspecies, the other has two, and they all have very distinct coat patterns.
Well, the story of your discovery begins when you were studying for your BA in biological anthropology a few years ago. Your dissertation focused on the archaic humans known as the Denisovans, as well as the mysterious ghost hominin species that their DNA tells us they'd interbred with. Can you tell us about that?
I've had a few questions like this in recent times, and I kind of forgot that I did this because all of my work now has, you know, been very much on the side of mammals and looking at mammal diversification and stuff. And I kind of forgot that I also did stuff with genetics, but that was my obsession for a while in my third year. So now I'm more proud that when I look back and read what I've actually done, I'm more proud of it now than I was then. So basically what I did was I looked at, to give some context, the Denisovans are a sister species to Neanderthals. So those two species are more closely related to each other than they are to humans, but we are all very closely related. And basically, if you look at its DNA, it's a bit weird. So I kind of did a weird, little investigation, I guess, into what was it doing? Because what is weird about its DNA is that it looks like, you'd expect the Denisovan genome and the Neanderthal genome to have roughly equal amounts of divergence, of difference, to the human genome, because they've shared a common ancestor, and then they diverge from each other. But they share a common ancestor with humans. You'd expect them to have roughly the same amount of differences with the modern human genome, and they don't, and that's weird. And so what I did in that dissertation was I looked at the Denisovan genome specifically because it has more differences than you'd expect. And so what I did was I isolated those bits of the genome that are very, very different, and then looked at what genes do you find in those areas? So what could the sort of functional consequences have been of these differences? And then the hypothesis was that those differences were the product of interbreeding with something that we don't know much about. So not Neanderthal and not human, something else. So like you say, a ghost, hominin. That's the that was the project.
Well, it was during your PhD that you became more and more intrigued by the natural processes that created diversity within mammals, and more specifically, how a subspecies may eventually become a totally new species. Laura, take us to that eureka moment when it hit you that the relationship between animal species and their subspecies was the key to understanding how evolution works.
It's not an entirely new idea. In fact, you can go all the way back to the 1940s and look at the stuff that Ernst Mayr was writing about. So he's the guy that is really big on, he invented he kind of coined the biological species concept. So he's big on reproductive isolation and how that emerges and how that creates new species. So what he said, and he was very active in the ornithological community. So he wrote a lot about birds, and he basically hypothesized that subspecies formation is the second of five stages of speciation in birds. So it's not an entirely novel idea, but like I've kind of alluded, it's received a lot of attention in birds. So then what I did was I kind of joked with my supervisor about this. We said we were going to write a paper called "Mammals Are Not Birds," because I basically wanted to see whether the patterns that we see in birds, do we see them in mammals? Yes or no. So I looked at correlations between subspecies richness and species richness. So all the analyses were done at the genus level. And I looked at the strength of the correlation between these two. And so what you see in birds is that it's a lot higher overall than what you see for mammals as a whole. So that to me was really weird. And that's where that idea of that paper called "Mammals Are Not Birds" came from. And so that's weird, because that kind of goes against what you'd expect if you're Mayr or if you're Darwin or if you're me, because I thought I was going to see something similar to birds. So then I started thinking about, why are mammals not birds? Why are they different? And the obvious thing is that, most birds fly and most mammals don't. So then I started thinking about the relationship between subspecies, ecology, and species. And so I did a very simple test. I just separated my data set and looked at, do we see a stronger correlation in the things that aren't terrestrial, so the flying and the swimming mammals, compared with those terrestrial mammals? So that for me is when the penny dropped. So that's the eureka moment, as it were, because what I saw was the correlation between subspecies richness and species richness is much higher in the non-terrestrial mammals. So those, again, are the flying and the swimming mammals. So that for me was the moment where I thought, okay, that's actually interesting, because we've made the model a little bit more complicated. We're not just saying that subspecies can turn into species, but we're saying that ecology mediates that relationship. So that for me was the eureka moment. I find it very funny talking about eureka moments, because I'm only me. And so eureka sounds so grand, So that But anyway, that's
as bad as the press, aren't
I?
Yeah.
Hyping me up. Yeah. Yeah.
Well, all of this, of course, goes back to Charles Darwin and his work on the origin of species. I think it was in chapter 3 that he speculates that a large genus of animals is more likely to give rise to lots of varieties, lots of subspecies. So what you found pretty much authenticates this, wouldn't you say?
Actually, I'm really pleased to use the word authenticate rather than prove. Because in the paper, you know, all we do is show a positive correlation. It's not even super, super strong. It's not like, you know, 0.9 or something. So we do show a positive correlation between these things, which I guess, like you say, authenticates what Darwin said. Mm. So he goes into detail a little bit, but he doesn't really explain why he thinks that's the case. He kind of goes into detail and says, oh, varieties, you know, could potentially form species, but it's all very... Well, if you've read, you know, literature from that era, it's all very grand, but it doesn't actually say that much. So it doesn't go into the mechanisms of, you know, why that should be the case. But yeah, it does go all the way back to Darwin, you're right.
Now, a lot of people are going to be wondering about human subspecies. Now, Neanderthals are sometimes referred to as a subspecies, and we know from DNA evidence that humans interbred with them. Is it possible that there are, or one day might be, human subspecies living alongside us? And when we say subspecies, we're definitely not talking about race or ethnicity, because that's a totally different thing, correct?
That's a big question. There's a lot to unpack. I think I'll go for the race question first. So do humans have subspecies? And then I'll move on to the Neanderthal side of things. So basically, humans don't have subspecies. I have to be very clear about that. They just don't. If you remember what I said about the definition of subspecies, it has to represent a unit that is a break from the rest. And what that means is that you can't have sort of in between. So say you have two subspecies, you shouldn't have in between forms, and what we have in humans is, if you look at you know, the thing that is most often talked about, skin color. If you, of course, there's differences in skin color. If I compared myself to someone from Bali to someone from Kenya, you would see differences in skin color. But if you sampled everyone or enough people, you would see that human variation, phenotypic variation, is clinal, and what that means it's just a gradient, and imposing discrete groupings on that is just, there's no way to do that. It's just, you know, that clip of Ed Miliband saying it's just wrong, it's just not right, it's just wrong. it's that, basically. It makes no sense. So it doesn't meet that criterion. And then when you look at the genetics of modern humans, we're incredibly similar, it's very surprising given the amount of phenotypic variation. So there is a lot of phenotypic variation in modern humans. But I think it surprises a lot of people to hear things like, if you look at chimpanzee subspecies, they're more differentiated from each other than two random people from different continents. Penguins have more genetic diversity than modern humans do. So when you look at it genetically, again, there's no case for subspecies. So it doesn't meet that criterion. And then you look at range, we're everywhere, and there's no real gaps between human populations. And there's so much interconnectivity. So yeah, some people, you know, I'm living on an island at the moment in the UK, but that island's pretty big. And also there's a lot of, well, not anymore because of the lockdown, but there's a lot of connectivity, right? So we're not isolated animal subspecies are. So basically, we don't meet any of the criteria. And actually, I get that question a lot when I talk about my research about are human races subspecies? And then I have to explain that, first of all, we can't make these discrete groupings in modern humans. We can't make these discrete groupings anyway, which means that we basically don't have subspecies. And then you get the question, but why don't we have these subspecies?
Or could there be?
Yeah, and could there be, exactly. Well, my answer to that is, yeah, there could be. if we colonized another planet, because we're such an interconnected species. So imagine a situation in which we colonize another planet and then don't, you know, exchange genes with them for, you know, hundreds of thousands of years, which would be a great topic for a book. That would lead to those groups becoming, you could classify them probably as subspecies if they become phenotypically distinct enough from each other.
Because for instance, if they went to another world, the gravity might be different and they might become tall and thin and winnowy and would look back at us back on Earth and go, oh, no, thank you.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, no, that's exactly right. And then for the Neanderthal question, that's a really interesting one because that's been a debate for a while. And the consensus in the anthropology community is that Neanderthals and humans are two separate species. And the reason for that is, okay, yeah, we interbred with them. So that sort of violates Meyer's biological species concept, which says that you're not supposed to be able to interbreed if you're two separate species. But I think it's more of not a failing of that definition, but a shortcoming of that definition, because it doesn't, first of all, it doesn't apply to a lot of organisms, things like plants or bacteria or, you know, things that don't sexually reproduce. But what you see in nature is lots of species, which are full species, still interbreed and hybridized. So you see that in baboons, for example. You see it in the big cats, too. Again, you know, the ligers from Tiger King. So they're all over the place. So things hybridize. And actually, when you look at the phenotypes of, so what Neanderthals actually looked like, this also blows people's mind, and it blows my mind too. You can differentiate ear bones of Neanderthals and humans based on shape and size. You can actually tell which one belongs to which species. And, you know, overall, the morphology is very, very different. So, even if they've, you know, obviously we did interbreed with them, but they're definitely on their way to becoming full species in the sort of biological species sense of the word. And in most other definitions of species, they would have already attained species status. But it's a good question, and it's stumped people, and people's opinions are still divided on it.
I mean, there have been, I think, subspecies when you look at, I mean, Homo erectus was around for 2 million odd years, the most successful hominid. And I think I'm correct in saying that we had like Homo heidelbergensis, which is perhaps a subspecies, or definitely Homo ergaster, which is African. Homo erectus was a subspecies. So we did have them at one point.
Yeah, but the thing is, it's very difficult to diagnose subspecies based on fossils because we don't. The main thing that people use to differentiate subspecies today is what they looked like on the outside. So in birds, it's a lot easier, and the animals I mentioned before, you know, they have distinct coloration. Obviously, we don't have that for the fossils, so it's a little bit more difficult to say. But basically, what's going on in humans is it's very messy, and people's opinions are very divided. You know, should we have many subspecies? Should we have many species? Or was it all just one lineage or a few lineages with lots of regional morphs? This kind of thing. And people are very divided about it. But I personally think...
And there's a big argument that let's call them all Homo erectus, everything from Homo erectus onward. Let's just call them all that, you know. That's another argument.
Exactly. Well, exactly. And then you see the stuff, all the recent publications, well, like recent as in, you know, 2015, those kinds of times, where you've got regionally, you know, in terms of the origin of modern humans, you've got very distinct phenotypes all across Africa that all have bits that lead us to say, well, they're very nearly fully modern human, but not quite. But they all have different bits that are archaic and different bits that look more like us. And to me, that screams subspecies. That screams and basically a subspecies that meets the criteria for a subspecies, right? Because they're in their own areas. They look distinct phenotypically. We don't know much about their genetics, but So I agree with you. There will have been subspecies in the hominin lineage for sure.
Well, the great thing about your work is that now it can be used by conservationists and environmentalists to predict how a species may or may not go extinct.
Yeah. So actually, for me, I think the real value of this, and it's something that I was writing up before we had this interview, is the idea that we can use subspecies as an indicator of what's going to happen to a species. So it's more an idea of, is it more or less likely that this species is going to split into subspecies, and those subspecies then become full species over time. So it's more an idea of looking forward to see what can be created out of a species. And so that's important for things like, you know, the conservation of biodiversity. Are you interested in keeping lots of future species, or are you interested in doing it a different way? But that's, I think, how it can be used. But also the idea that species make subspecies in different ways. Maybe that's bad phrasing, but the idea that the process of how subspecies are formed is different according to, you know, whether you're terrestrial or not terrestrial, means that we can start thinking about, okay, so how will a barrier in the landscape affect the future evolution of an endangered species? Because it'll do so differently for terrestrial mammals versus, you know, flying ones. Because imagine a bat can fly over a road, but maybe some kind of shrew or some kind of mouse, you know, they can't cross the road, so they're more likely to become subdivided populations.
And we know the bonobos were cut off from chimpanzees.
But yes, they were separated. So there you go. And actually, that's a good point to sort of say, subspecies don't inevitably turn into species. And that's what makes them interesting to me. They sit at this interesting boundary between, well, there's a few alternatives. So a subspecies can over time become a species. And that's the sort of Meyerian sense of a subspecies. It can just remain a subspecies forever and ever and ever, as long as the species doesn't go extinct. Or it can, you know, through interbreeding, join the bigger gene pool of the rest of the species. And that's what those tiger people are doing by illegally breeding them, is mixing these subspecies up again. So basically the point is that a subspecies doesn't inevitably become a species. But on the other hand, all species will have been subspecies in the past. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it's very interesting.
It's a bit of a logical conundrum, but in this definition of subspecies.
And nobody really, really had figured that out before, that we're all subspecies at one point.
Well, do you know what? I think, you know, people like Meyer do make that point. And I think some primate authors have made this point as well. But because people are very wary of it's a very unsexy taxonomic unit. And what I mean by that is people are very uncertain if what we call a subspecies actually represents a subspecies, you know, genetically, or because if you think we haven't had a lot of genetic data for a lot of species for a very long time.
Yeah.
So sort of checking whether or not we've actually named these units in the way we want to name them has made people a bit wary of using them in models. And that's, so the paper that I just published has like an enormous amount of behind the scenes analyses that we don't present in the actual paper. It's all in the supplementaries. It's all checking to see if the definition of a subspecies is slightly different. What does that do to the correlations? Basically validating what we're concluding. So I think people have been scared of using subspecies in their models. And it's just that I was, not really stupid enough to just do it, but, you know, kind of young and irreverent enough to... to see what comes out. I think that's,
and I think people don't like the word sub as well. It sounds almost like, you know, beneath and not as good, and subpar. I mean, perhaps call it alt species or some new term
come around one day. I like proto species.
Oh, I love that.
Then people might start paying more attention to it in a sort of
that's a much better term. I like
that. We'll call it that then.
Yes.
Okay, that was so interesting, and thank you, Laura, not only for coming on to Evolution Soup, but for the work you've done in this very important field. And if anyone wants to follow your work, I'll leave links in the description below, and hopefully we will speak again on the channel in the very near future.
Well, thank you so much for having me on, Mark. It's been a lot of fun.